It said that there was going to be a sermon called Struggling Towards the Beauty. With the events of this week, the more I thought about the sermon, the more I felt like I just wanted to focus on something a little bit different. And that is, with the same sort of theme of taking shape together. The passage from Jeremiah this week is one that many of you who've grown up in church and know. I'm going to just repeat a little bit of it in class. There's one phrase in there that sticks out in many of our minds. Is there no balm in Gilead? Is there no physician there? Why then has the health of my people not been restored? This is one of those passages in the Old Testament that we draw a lot of our Christian liturgy from, just like that passage. 2 weeks ago, we talked about from Jeremiah about the potter and the clay. There are a lot of images of potter and clay in our songs and in our Christian liturgy. There are also a lot of images of balm and Gilead, right, in the liturgy. And some of you know the song from the balm. Is there a balm in Gilead? You know that song, right? And so this is one of those passages that has been used, but often misunderstood because in social context, again, it hasn't really been thought about particularly well. And before I talk about this, I just want to remind you about this balm. Some of us, when we think of balm, we think of lip balm, or Burt's Bees balms, or whatever it is. But this... this particular word in Hebrew, city, is a word that describes something that's really not what we consider balm, more like a salve, an ointment made from a resin of a tree. And the resin of a particular tree, I think the word is Camphora gileadensis, which grew in southern Arabia and was cultivated in Palestine long before time of Abraham. So we're talking about a long time it's been cultivated up in Palestine because people knew that if you took the bark of this tree and soaked it in water and put it on people's wounds, miraculously those wounds would heal better than wounds that were just left to heal on their own. Or if you took the resin from that tree, if you prick the side of it and sap oozes out and it turns into resin, you can dry that, transport it all around in its dry form. Mix it with a little bit of water or even wine, drink it, and your health would improve. And so people thought about this tree, Camphora gileadensis, as being sort of a special tree. It's a healing tree. And so we have this balm, this salve made from the tree that we call the balm of Gilead in the Bible. In different parts of Arabia, they call it the balsam of Mecca, which operates in a lot of different ways. It operates not only as a potion to cleanse and heal you, but also as a perfume, because if you smell this, it smells really good. That's why when I first thought about this passage, I thought about this really interesting connection that we don't have in modern Western medicine anymore, between medicine and perfume. Something that heals you and makes the place just beautiful. And actually, they would take this resin and they would burn it at certain times and leave a scent in the air that they thought was not only a pleasant scent to smell, but also something healing for the body. This happens with a lot of different resins from trees in the ancient Near East. And so when you remember the story of the wise men coming to visit Jesus at his birth in the Matthew account, and they bring gold and frankincense and myrrh. Myrrh also is a resin from Camphora. That has been used to make fragrance in the air and salve bodies. Frankincense, actually the French word for that means fine incense, frankincense. And it's also the resin from the trees. But it's really interesting that when Jeremiah speaks these words, is there no balm in Gilead? What he knows is, and what everybody hearing these words would know, is that there is balm in function is. It's been cultivated over on the hills of Gilead for, by the time of Gilead, speaking, at least 1,000 years. From our point of view, 3,000 years. There's camphora trees all over Gilead because that's where their names is. The more interesting question that he asks is this. Is there no physician there? Is there no raha there? Is there nobody who can take what we know is growing there on the hillside and is available for our healing? Is there nobody who can take that and turn it into something that heals us? Remember when Jeremiah was writing this, he's writing this, he's proclaiming this as a tradition goes, 10 years, 15 years, maybe before the complete and utter destruction of Jerusalem by the Babylonian Empire. Jeremiah knows that because of the wickedness of the leaders of Judah at that time, that there was extortion of the poor going on, that's why we keep hearing about the poor in this entire section. The priests were complicit with this extortion and weren't requiring that the statutes of the law that protected the poor from exploitation were being obeyed. Jeremiah is saying to the people here, we're all hurting, we're all sad, we're all in a horrible condition. But is there no woman being given? Are there even no physician here? What is he saying when he's saying this to people? Don't we have the resources amongst us that make for our healing? And aren't there any people who are actually going to take these resources and use them for the healing of the nation? I think what Jeremiah is thinking right now, when he's saying this back in his day, was, is there no word of Adonai? Right? Is there no law? I think that's the image he's making to the balm of Gilead. And aren't there physicians? Aren't there raha? Aren't there people who will take that law and actually enforce it? Aren't there leaders who will do justice? Aren't there religious leaders who will remind us of the most important things of mercy, compassion, treating each other as we ought to, as brothers and sisters? And I'm reminded as I listen to this that 600 years later in the Jesus movement, here comes Jesus on the scene after John the Baptist. And Bible scholar John Dominic Crawford asks a very interesting question. Why did the John the Baptist movement, whose leader was executed, remember his head was cut off, why did the John the Baptist movement not survive? And why did the Jesus movement, whose leader was also executed on the cross, why did that survive when John Newman didn't? Good question. When you think about it, though, the answer is pretty clear. The John movement depended on one person. It was one person, just like Jeremiah out there, his lone voice in the wilderness saying, is there no awe in Gilead? Is there no physician here? Is there nobody who's going to implement this? John was out there in the wilderness saying, come and be baptized. And when John died, there was no more voice in the wilderness. And when Jesus came on the scene, what did Jesus do? Jesus, one of the first things we learned that Jesus did in each one of the gospel stories is that he chose people to be close followers, who would follow him around and be with him and know him. And then we very soon after that learned that he would train these people who are closest to him and be in solidarity and community with them in a way that helped them to understand what makes for our healing. Right relationship. God's shalom. Not just doing justice, but also living in mercy, forgiveness. All of these things we learned about in the Sermon on the Mount. If we're going to ever become the world that God intends to create in this planet, we're going to have to have compassion for one another. Love God with all of our friends and neighbors as ourselves. This is going to be the key. Understanding one another as brothers and sisters in the human community. Let's try that out in a small group where we can support each other and live that way with one another. And they did that. And then Jesus takes the 12 in Luke chapter 9 and sends them out and says, go to all the villages and say this word. And he goes out to all the villages and these disciples go out and they create small communities of solidarity where people start sharing this vision. We've got to be the kind of people that God is going to be able to use to create maybe these little pockets of solidarity and people saving and community and caring for each other and being with each other and for each other. And so when the Romans decide that Jesus is becoming a little bit too annoying and we crucify him on the cross, guess what? That movement doesn't die. That movement doesn't die because Jesus has said, you take it. You spread this message. This is your thing now. It's not Jesus' movement. It's not a top-down movement where you needed a prophet in order to proclaim the word. Jesus' movement was a bottom-up movement where Jesus was saying, we now, we're going to have to, this change is going to happen. We're going to have to make it happen amongst ourselves in these small communities of solidarity. This is where it happens. And the New Testament church afterwards takes some of Jesus' words, who knows if Jesus actually spoke these or not, but certainly they interpreted them this way. When Jesus says, where two or three are gathered in my name, there I am. It doesn't matter that I am. It matters that two or three of you are there in this community of solidarity and care, living out this vision of a just world in that relationship. I am the vine, Jesus said, you are the branches. If you abide in me and I abide in you, and so you can cut one of those branches off, but you can't cut the plant down because the plant is like, remember the parables of the seed sown. Once it's sown, it just keeps growing. So you can't stop it. You can't control it because it's loose in the world. And that's what happened to Jesus when he got loose in the world. And all of a sudden, we have these little communities of people who say, our rulers are not going to do it. They're not going to find their relationship, and they're not going to support us. We're going to have to support ourselves. We're going to have to do it ourselves. And it's in these small communities of people who Paul beautifully called the body of Christ that the mission continued. What does that mean? That means that when Jesus died, the historical Jesus died, Christ lived on. Christ lived on in Jerusalem, and that group of people that were meeting in Jerusalem, covenanting with themselves to be the voice and hands and feet of Jesus Christ, lived on in Samaria, in Judea, and in Asia Minor, in different places. Each of those places saying, we are going to be Christ here. We're going to do this for each other. We are going to be the balm of Gilead. We are going to do that. And when I think about the world taking shape, it seems like that's something we need to remember. That there is pain in the world. Just as this passage, there's a lot of pain in this passage. There's pain in our lives too. And a call to us is the same call that goes out there. Is there no balm in Gilead? Do we not have the resources that we need to heal the nations? Yes. Is there no physician there? Is there no rabbi there who can take it and actually apply it in day-to-day living to the people who need it? Is there no one there? Yes. It's in each place where there is a body of Christ. And so I was confused the first time I ever heard theologian Stanley Hauerwas say, the main job of the church is to be the church. I got really ticked off. The main job of the church is to see the hungry, the justice, the power, and all these other things. The point he was making is this. The main job of the church is to be the body of Christ, which includes feeding the poor, speaking justice, and all these things, but it also includes the healing and comforting and gathering and ministry of Jesus. And that's what we're called to be, the whole body of Christ. At times when we feel pain and loss, those are the times when we realize just how important it is that we are the body of Christ. And that's the beauty of communion. When we celebrate communion at this church, we don't think, you know, there's a lot of people who think lots of different things about communion. Maybe you think differently than I do. But I don't think that when I break this bread and we say this is the body of Christ, that this gluten-free loaf that I bought at the Going Green Store actually is the the selves of Jesus Christ. When we break the body of Christ and we say, this is my body, it is for you, what we're saying is, I am Christ, and you are Christ, and together we are Christ. And if we're not, there is no Christ in the world. We are Christ for each other. We hold each other up. People say to me sometimes, I don't feel like I am important in the church. I heard somebody say that recently, and I thought to myself, that's one of the saddest comments I've ever heard. You have no idea how important just being here on Sunday is for this church. You may have no idea how your encouragement and the words spoken one day a week can lift another person. You may have no idea how important your gift of service, no matter how small it is, may encourage other people. And your financial donation, as small or modest as it is, encourages this kind of community that supports one another. So as we take communion today, I encourage you to remember again, is there no home in Gilead? Is there no physician there? Why then has the health of my people not been restored? Oh God, we thank you for the prophetic opportunity and the pastoral opportunity you give us to be the body of Christ in this place. In times of grief and loss, in times when we need to be ourselves, who we are, with all of our brokenness and all of our hurt and all of our pain, we have other people to rely on, to be honest with, to share that grief and sorrow with, and who will lift us up and encourage us when we feel like the work that we're doing doesn't particularly matter. We have other people to lift us up and say, we need you, we need each other for the world to be. Give us that confidence again and faith in you.